CFM 93.2 is a charity and works with the diverse communities in Bristol. So please continue to support us by getting involved and spreading the word.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show, Friday Drive Time, with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. The latest book on the death of Princess Diana out this week says the Queen chaired the meeting where the decision was made to assassinate. And it's the cuts, massive changes to housing benefit, the new bedroom tax, benefit caps and the introduction of something called the Universal Credit. We talked to Will Stone from Avon and Bristol Law Centre about what changes are taking place and when. Also to a former traveller who experienced Margaret Thatcher's convoy crackdown in the 1980s. Plus, Republican US presidential frontrunner in this winter's election is Mormon Mitt Romney. But what is the Book of Mormon, and what do the Church of Jesus Christ of the Latter-day Saints actually believe? We find out from one of two Mormon bishops in Bristol, Robert Webb from Whitchurch. But first, Martin Summers is here from our weekly reconnaissance tour across world politics. Martin, what do you make then of this latest announcement from John Morgan, who we interviewed on this programme a few months ago, from his last book, saying that actually he believes that some of the senior members of the royal family may have actually been involved in something called the Way Ahead Group about a month before, and actually saying that Princess Diana should be dispatched?
Well, I mean, I haven't read the book. It's an allegation. We know that there's lots of suspicions about this death, as there are suspicions about lots of deaths, like David Kelly's death or the other Portland Down scientist who died a couple of weeks ago. It's legitimate to ask questions. It's always legitimate to ask questions.
What about this this idea that apparently Kate, who used to be Kate Middleton, she's now married to Prince William, that she's one of the people that really wants to find out the truth, and she's now talking in the Globe magazine, at least that's what it says, about reopening the inquest because she wants to get to the bottom of it.
Well, there's clearly people who are unhappy about what happened. I've heard lots of stories from different people. Some people connected with Princess Diana who I've spoken to have not been happy about what happened. People are murdered by the state. People have got to get over that. David Kelly was murdered by the state, for example. That's pretty clear. And nothing was done about it. If one person can be murdered by the state like that, others can be. And we should always keep an open mind.
Now, the Pentagon, the next story. The Pentagon is condemning the war on Islam, which is a US Army training course. General Martin Dempsey has ordered a full investigation, this is news just out today, into a course being taught by the US Army War College. The course has now been suspended, but the voluntary course at the Joint Forces Staff College in Virginia suggested possible nuclear attacks on holy Muslim cities such as Mecca. What was going on here?
Well, I mean, this is extremely worrying. You've got people in the United States and in this country who've completely misunderstood what's going on or have understood only too well. This is absolutely unacceptable. Eric Prince, who set up Blackwater, he was training his mercenaries on the idea... and of course, he's a fundamentalist Christian, and he was saying, you are going to Iraq to kill Muslims. That's what he was saying to them, which is eventually why he lost various contracts, or they're still employed by the US government. We're on a slippery slope to a very nasty destination. The economy's about to collapse. People are talking about a war on Islam. This is absolutely insane.
It's quite a pernicious version of Christianity, this. It doesn't sound like the sort of thing Jesus would be into.
Indeed.
And also rather similar to the kind of Anders Breivik style version of...
Yes, and this is all being paid for by US taxpayers. Anders Breivik, we don't know who was pulling his strings, but at least ostensibly nobody was paying for him. But these people are using US taxpayers' money to push this stuff. They should lose their jobs. They should be out of a job. They should be barred from all public employment.
It's worth saying that the story was leaked on, very well done to them, on Wired.com on their Danger Room blog. And also, what are your thoughts on the announcement that the course has been suspended? Because it does imply that at some point it may be resurrected again in the future.
Well, the people concerned should be disciplined to the extent of being sacked or possibly prosecuted, never mind suspended. And this is the problem that we've got. I mean, we've seen this underpants bomber plot this week where it turns out the guy is actually a double agent, a Saudi-British double agent. I thought we were trying to overthrow the Saudi government. Remind me again which side we're on. And, of course, the original underpants bomber got onto the plane as Kurt Haskell, the top lawyer, was on the plane, just said at the trial. He got on the plane without being taken through security, without even a passport. And people want to check that. Can check that. Kurt Haskell, K-U-R-T. H-A-S-K-E-E-L. He was an eyewitness on the plane. It's been reported all over the world, in the media in India and Pakistan and Iran, Russia Today. They've all reported it. But of course the BBC and the mainstream media here didn't report at the time, and have still not reported, that the so-called underpants bomber was clearly a patsy put onto the plane by the security services. So there are terrorists out there, and they're inside the security structure. Bring on the police service of Northern Ireland, that's what I say.
Well, what do you mean by a patsy?
A patsy is somebody who's talked into it, like these five anarchists that were supposedly going to blow up a bridge in Cleveland, Ohio. They were approached by the FBI, who said, "Hey, you anarchists, you stoned anarchists, would you like to blow up the bridge? Hey, we'll even get some explosives for you." And then, of course, they provided them the explosives and then nabbed them all. Virtually everybody who's been arrested in the US for terrorism has been entrapped in the same way. They are usually losers. Drug addicts, criminals, petty thieves, and then they are framed up as major terrorists. The FBI pockets the money, and on we go with the so-called war on terrorism, where it's absolutely clear that the real terrorists are inside the power structure. That's the people in Northern Ireland. They know how that works.
Now, maybe someone you may agree is not necessarily just a patsy. It's the mastermind of the 9/11 attacks, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. He has been mocking an American court as he's charged with planning almost 3,000 murders. He and four co-accused refused to answer questions, ignored the judge, and stood to pray at random moments to read the Quran or magazines in a US court. It's a military court, actually, at Guantanamo Bay, which I thought was supposed to be closed down. But let's go to Australia now for a report on that particular court case from Alison Caldwell at ABC News Australia. And this may be a version of events which you haven't necessarily heard in Britain, because this is an interview, what she does is an interview with Khalid Sheikh Mohammed's lawyer.
Kuwaiti-born Pakistani 47-year-old Khalid Sheikh Mohammed has admitted he was responsible for the September 11 attacks, along with 30 other plots, and the murder of Wall Street Journal reporter Daniel Pearl. His defense lawyer is David Nevin. He says the system is rigged for convictions.
I can't tell you what my client has said to me. I can't tell you what his thinking is, because I'm forbidden from doing that. Everything that he says is presumptively classified at the top secret level.
Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was waterboarded 183 times during the 3 years he was held in secret CIA prisons after he was captured in Pakistan in 2003. He was eventually transferred to Guantanamo Bay, where he was deprived of sleep for 7 days straight. Speaking to Al Jazeera, David Nevin said his immediate priority is to improve communications with his client.
The thought police are out everywhere here. What I want to do right now is be able to have a conversation with my client about what happened to him while he was held incommunicado and tortured by my government for 3 years. I want to be able to talk to him about that. And the rules that are in place now don't even allow me to talk to him about that.
Well, here we go. We're just being... This is an absolutely kangaroo court. It's got no legal basis at all. The lawyer can't even speak to his client. General Ivashov, the commander of the Russian armed forces on 9/11, people can look him up, Leonid Ivashov, I-V-A-S-H-O-V. He said, as far as we're concerned, that was an inside job. You don't hear that on Radio 4. You hear it on Bristol Community Radio.
On to Syria, then. And we've had, yesterday, a massive double bombing attack. I mean, this seems to be the style nowadays, is that one enormous bomb goes off, and then as people arrive on the scene to help the victims, the people dead and dying, then another bomb goes off, and those people are caught in that too, Martin.
Yes, and of course the opposition in Syria, which is being backed by the West, I mean, we understand British special forces have already been inside Syria, they are basically saying, oh no, we didn't plant that bomb, the Syrians planted the bomb at their own intelligence headquarters to discredit us. This is what we call false flag terrorism. So false flag terrorism is perfectly understandable when the Syrians might or might not be doing it, but when we say that the US government and the British government engage in false flag terrorism, we're conspiracy theorists. No, we're not. We're just talking about how the world really works.
Well, let's have a
actual fact, bombs go off all the time and you never know who's doing what.
Well, let's have a listen now to one view of what's going on in Syria from Christoph Horstall.
According to my sources in Syria, XE services task is doing targeted killings, doing terrorist attacks, and then also engaging in shootouts with security personnel or interfering in peaceful demonstrations. So we have all kinds of activities as in the past, but this time it seems, as they say, that this is XE services furnishing the mercenaries themselves.
XE services.
That's former Blackwater. You mentioned Eric Prince earlier. That's Blackwater. And there's lots of evidence to suggest, and the Syrians have actually been putting out press conferences where they've captured people saying, look, we're capturing your mercenaries, but we're not hearing it in the West. It's still about, remember, this has been going on for a year now, and all these peaceful demonstrators are being gunned down by the horrible regime in Syria. Oh, hang on a minute, they've just planted a bomb and killed 50 people. Oh, right, that would be right then. Perhaps we should plant a few bombs in Bahrain and start attacking the Bahraini's allies or the Saudis. They've all got to go. I mean, let's face it, there's going to have to be a bloody revolution. I mean, Gaddafi was killed on YouTube. Maybe we should kill the King of Saudi Arabia on YouTube and his allies, like David Cameron and Obama. They're all targets, aren't they? We all know that.
But Martin, I thought you weren't a man of violence.
No, I'm just pointing out the contradictions in the Western position. When our lot go around bombing things, that's fine. When other people bomb us, that's terrible. Now, in actual fact, it's all terrible, and the situation is very, very bad. A lot of the terrorism going on out there is being run by intelligence services and not just by the Syrian intelligence services.
Okay, finally then, the Bilderberg must die for the world to live. Now that's a bit biased, but that's my comment. Now, one of the things I focus on though in this thing about the Bilderberg conference, and then better explain who they are, this is a rich, powerful, elite secret meeting that takes place in one of the NATO countries once a year, made up of the heads of the various central banks, the places like the European Central Bank, also the IMF and the World Bank, plus royalty, some of the top royalty from right across Europe, and the big corporations, including media corporations and Rupert Murdoch's general manager, people like that, and also at least one of the trustees from the BBC. Ultimately, Martin, what do you think may be on the Bilderberg agenda this year? Because we're hearing from Alex Jones in the United States that there's going to be an attempt this year to actually occupy the conference.
Well, that will be, you know, the Occupy movement trying to assert itself. I mean, I presume what will be on the agenda is A, the banking collapse, and B, the coming world war. I mean, that's what I'd want to discuss if I was at Bilderberg.
And what will be, do you think, some of the conclusions from such a meeting, if they're allowed to do it, or if they're able to do it? I mean, what's happening is it's going to be taking place in a very, very high security area, just down the road from the headquarters of the Central Intelligence Agency, opposite the National Reconnaissance Office.
Yeah, well, that just shows you what they're going to be discussing. I mean, the Russian army are preparing for war this summer in the Middle East.
One of the key figures at Bilderberg is this guy Henry Kissinger. Can you just tell us a bit about his track record?
Well, he's been around for a long time. He bombed Cambodia illegally, killing millions of people. He overthrew the democratically elected government of Chile, killing thousands of people. He's a war criminal, and in fact he can't travel in many places in the world because he should be arrested and put in prison, never mind Khalid Sheikh Mohammed.
He's one of these sort of movers and shakers behind the scenes. I read a book recently which explained that he was behind the Turkish invasion of Cyprus too.
Indeed, he's got a track record as long as your arm. And of course, these people aren't criminals, they are in charge.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Now, on to our next topic, which is the Universal Credit and Benefit Cap. I'm joined by Will Stone from Avon and Bristol Law Centre. Hi, Will. Welcome to Drive Time. Now, can you tell us, first of all, this whole idea of changing the entire benefit system to something called the Universal Credit? What is the Universal Credit?
The Universal Credit is a lot of families, a lot of people on benefits will be getting a range of benefits. They won't just be getting one benefit at the moment. They may be on income support, or they may be on job seekers allowance. employment and support allowance, if they have long-term sickness or disability. There's also, of course, housing benefit, child benefit. All of those benefits are going to be lumped together into one payment, which is being referred to as the universal credit.
And what point is this going to kick in? Or is it something that's going to come in bit by bit, slowly? And when will we actually have a new entire system with the universal credit being the only type of benefit out there?
As far as I'm aware, the government's intending to bring it in next April.
OK. What about this bedroom tax, then? Because this is something that we've been hearing about, that the idea that you may have a spare bedroom, in future the government won't be paying for that spare bedroom.
Yes, that's right. It's called the bedroom tax, otherwise known as the housing benefit cap. It does actually already apply in the private rented sector at the moment, but from next April it will cover the entire housing sector, so that includes council housing and housing association housing as well, which is essentially, if you have a spare bedroom, and how that's defined is going to be a matter for the government, not how, say, the person on the street might see it. There are going to be particular rules as to how many bedrooms you ought to have. Perhaps the most worrying one of which is that a family, for example, at the moment, mum and dad in one bedroom, maybe they've got two children aged, say, 8 and 9, a boy and a girl, they may be working at the moment. If the working partners lose their job through no fault of their own within the next year, then if they're in council housing at the moment, their housing benefit, the rent, they will not get that rent covered by housing benefit. It will be cut because the government will say, well, the two children, even though they're both of different genders, will have to share a bedroom. So two children who at the moment have their own bedrooms, have their own toys, have their own things that they enjoy, will be forced into one bedroom, or the parents will get a reduced amount of housing benefit. The rent won't be paid.
Isn't the simple way around this simply to turn the bedroom into a study or something? Because apparently there's no definition now of exactly what a bedroom is.
Well, the way it works, I'm afraid, even in social housing law, is that a room is a bedroom. For example, people who are applying for a flat will not be regarded as overcrowded if two members of the family have to sleep on the sofa in the living room. That would be regarded as a room that can be used as a bedroom. The only rooms that can't be used as a bedroom, according to housing legislation, would be a kitchen and a bathroom.
Martin, how is this actually going to affect the housing market? Because I know you're always talking on here about how artificial the housing market is. It's been used as a sort of bubble, and it's been pumped up until houses are worth much, much more than they would actually cost to construct.
Indeed, and when we were talking about the mansion tax, the Conservatives were going on about, oh, there might be a little old lady who's living in a mansion, and we couldn't have a mansion tax on her because she might have to sell, or because there might be loads of rooms in the house, but she might have to sell the house that she put her whole life into, and therefore we can't have a mansion tax. But for the poor, kick them out.
So ultimately, Will, is this going to mean people are simply going to have to move home, or what is the impact going to be? Because we heard a couple of weeks ago, didn't we, about the Newham Council in London talking about 500 families possibly having to move out of Newham and up north.
Yeah, I think that's a separate thing. I think that's more to do with shortage of housing in Newham, but I think you'd have to ask somebody from Newham about that. But one of the things that the government have said in their own assessments of the impact on this is that they're hoping that it will move people out of the social housing sector into the private rented sector. That means possibly a return to what we refer to as Rackmanism, where you have families living in overcrowded slums. Another aspect, which I just would like to mention, of the universal credit is, as well as the housing benefit being capped through the bedroom tax, there will also be a limit on the amount of benefit a family can provide. Now, that can be provided with by the state, regardless of the number of children. Either a couple or a single parent or a single person will only be able to get a particular amount of benefit per week. At the moment, that's everything. At the moment, it's capped as £500 for couples or single parents with children, or for single people, it's going to be £350. That includes all of their housing costs. Now, Bristol City Council have released figures this week that shows that's going to affect about 500 people in the poorest parts of Bristol. That's 500 families in the poorest parts of Bristol, and is going to mean a loss to them on average of nearly £100 a week.
So how will people be able to deal with that? What will people have to do? I mean, well, I suppose the other thing is, you know, okay, so there is the possibility that they may have to move, they will have to find somewhere, they have to find a deposit, all that sort of thing. But is there anything that they can do to appeal these kinds of decisions?
Those kind of decisions cannot be appealed, no, because those will just be a matter of applying the rules. The rules will say, well, if you're a couple and you've got a family, sorry, but you can't have more than this amount of benefit per week, whatever your circumstances. If you're a single person, it's going to be a lot less. What the government's hoping is it's going to force people into work. That probably means, of course, we know, low-paid work.
Well, the other problem is that there are also lots and lots of young people who may not even have their own place who are also looking for work between 18 and 24. Plus, there's lots of older people who are being forced to work longer as well. So it's like there's a massively increasing pool of people who are looking for work without... you just open up the Wednesday edition of the Evening Post, the jobs simply aren't there.
That's right, the jobs aren't there. I mean, my particular field of law is employment. I'm getting calls from people on a daily basis who are losing their jobs.
Employment and support.
Well, employment and support allowance is something else. That's the government's attempt to get people who are on long-term disability and sickness benefits into work. It's caused a major problem because of the people who are being assessed by the private companies that the government are using as being fit for work or appealing those. The appeal system is currently at crisis point. They can't deal with the numbers of appeals, but up to nearly 50% of those appeals are successful and the people are put back onto the sickness and benefit, and it's confirmed that they are in fact not fit for work.
Martin, this is a little bit worrying, this whole business, isn't it? It seems to be a kind of symptom of the deindustrialisation of the country. Since we're not actually making things hardly anymore in Britain, most of the stuff is being made in the Far East, places like that, that the jobs simply aren't there and not generating the tax income, and it's meaning that there's going to be an massively increasing pool of unemployed people. Now, this suits certain people, like big business. They love this because they can play one employee off against another, sack somebody in the knowledge that someone will be desperate to take that job pretty much straight away. But what's the solution to this ultimately?
Well, ultimately, don't forget that all of this is economically irrational. All of these cuts in benefits and all the rest of it have just led to a situation where the economy is about to fall down a hole. And that, in fact, is stupid. And there are more rational business people who understand very well that austerity is not the answer. What they've effectively done is they've made the unemployed, the sick and the poor to blame for the collapse of the private banking system. And the private bankers have been bailed out. There was no quantitative easing this week, but there might have been another big handout for them. Meanwhile, we're going to dump it all on these people at the bottom of the pile, and we're going to try and create as much as possible hostility to the people at the bottom of the pile. Look at these people on benefits. You've got a job. Look at these people on benefits. They're taking money off you. In actual fact, as we saw earlier, 0.03% of the population have just made $155 billion in the last 4 years of the crisis. That's where the money is. We want it.
Now, not wishing to steal Will's thunder at all, I did have a chat this week to Anna Bennett from Devonshire's solicitor, and spoke to her also about this whole thing, the universal credit, the benefit cap and the bedroom tax. And she explained that there are some case studies as to whether this kind of thing has been tried in the past.
I'm Anna Bennett and I work for Devonshire's solicitors. I am their welfare reform expert. For residents, the thing you need to be concerned about is that there will be a universal credit coming in October 2014, which will mean that housing benefit is no longer a separate entity that gets paid directly to your landlord. That means that you will become responsible for paying your rent and for budgeting for that rent.
Is there any experience of in the past, this has been done before, to see how this kind of thing might affect debt levels? Because obviously if the onus is suddenly on people who are disabled or possibly addicts, you know, these sorts of people, if the money's being paid into their account, they're more likely to spend it if they've got a bank account.
Well, in 2003 there was an experiment by London and Quadrant for a about 300,000 of their households. They experimented with direct payment. the result for the landlord was not that encouraging, in that bad debt increased, well, doubled from 3% to 7% for that stock. In terms of what's coming with universal credit and direct payments, there is going to be some provision for vulnerable tenants. However, there's no definition as yet as to what vulnerable means. And what the government's doing is that they're running 6 demonstration projects around the country between local authorities and housing associations with a select group of their stock and tenants to pilot the direct payments. As part of them demonstrations, each project will set different trigger points, they say, for bad debt. So where the arrears have arisen for a certain number of weeks, then direct payments start going to the landlord, and for the definition of vulnerability. So it's really, once the conclusion of those demonstration projects come in play in June 2013, then we'll be in a better position to say whether vulnerable tenants will be accounted for.
Well, it sounds like they don't really know, Will, what a lot of these definitions of these various types of people are, like what is a vulnerable tenant. But the thing that bothers me is that a lot of this, it seems it's all going to be going into people's bank accounts, and there's actually quite a lot of people out there who don't have a bank account.
Well, yeah, and I mean, what happened about 10 or 15 years ago was that the government stopped paying it into people's bank account because they thought it was far more sensible to pay direct to the landlords. Now everything seems to have been switched around so that everything has to go into a bank account or a post office account or something like that. A lot of people who are vulnerable people do find those difficult to manage. On the one hand, the government is saying, well, they shouldn't be managing a bank account. Now they're saying that they should.
Now, housing benefit cuts, there's a meeting of some sort anyway going on next Friday between 7:30 and 9:30 at the Council House. Can you tell us about that?
That's right, yes, that's put together by an organisation called Bristol Poverty Action, and it's a poverty hearing at the Bristol Council House next Friday between 7:30 and 9:30, making the point that 6,500 private tenants in Bristol face cuts of 15 to 25 a week in the housing benefit, forcing many people into homelessness, and also making the point that an average of 9 people every day are chasing a private tenancy.
9 people every day. Well, that's the other thing is, I suppose the key thing here, Will, is what should people do if they're worried that it looks like that their money that they've got coming in, for example, in benefits, is simply not going to be able to pay the bills. What should they do?
Well, I mean, they can get advice from their local advice centre. There are many advice centres around Bristol who can give them advice. One particular problem that people may want to respond to is the fact that it's been announced as well this week that the DWP, the Department of Works and Pension, have sent out letters to thousands of families across the country, and a good proportion of those have been to people who haven't been affected by the cuts, who won't be affected by the cuts. People with disabled children have received letters incorrectly telling them their benefits about to be cut. If people are worried, they should go to their local advice centre. People want to contact the Law Centre in Bristol and Stokes Croft. We can signpost them to their local advice centre. If we can't help them ourselves, just go onto our website, which is ablc.org.uk, or alternatively just put us in a search engine, Avon and Bristol Law Centre. Bristol Law Centre would probably do it.
Okay, well, just to round up, can you give us your phone number as well, in case people want to give you a call next week sometime, just to at least get a steer and be signposted, as you say?
0117 924 8662.
And we'll finish up this particular topic with Martin. Martin, I'd just like to get an idea from you. I mean, I realise that you don't think that these cuts are actually necessary and they may be counterproductive. So where do you think the money could come from to pay these kinds of benefits which are now being capped and cut?
We need to move, as the Greens have been saying for years, towards a citizen's income, where we basically guarantee all British citizens are living. And on top of that, they can work as little or as much as they like. And that means if you're sick, disabled, unemployed, you've got your basic benefit. And some people may choose not to work at all, to write poetry, to do something else. We've actually invented all of these machines to do the work for us. Let's make sure they do it and make sure we don't.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Now, I'm joined by Sean from Montpellier. Hi, Sean. Welcome to Drive Time.
Hello, Tony.
Now, I wanted to have you on for here for quite a long time because we're often talking about housing. Now, you're somebody who actually doesn't necessarily like to live in a house. I find that amazing.
No, a lot of people find it very constricting. There's no chance of moving anywhere, changing your opportunity. There are people stuck in dreadful council flats in awful night sink ghetto areas, and they don't have any choice. They're trapped there by their benefits, effectively.
Now, I know you spent a lot of your youth, if you could call it, maybe misspent or otherwise, and middle age, actually, as a traveller, that is to say, living in a vehicle.
Yes, and I think that in 20 years ago, there were so many people who'd made a conscious decision not to live in a building, and they only wished to live somewhere where they had a little bit more freedom, maybe out in the country rather than in some awful city or town, which they otherwise would have been trapped
in. Well, can you tell us why you made that choice? You know, you decided to buy a vehicle and live in that and sort of go around with other travellers in a convoy.
My quality of life was far better for a much smaller income than it would have been. It was costing me so much to live, I didn't really have any prospects. As soon as I didn't have those expenses for my housing so much, then the world opened up for me. And it was much cheaper to live a really good quality of life in a vehicle than to live terribly in some awful bedsit somewhere.
Okay, well, tell us about the quality of life. What was it that you could do that you couldn't necessarily do if you were stuck on a council estate somewhere?
You can't wake up in the morning, look out of your window of your bedsit and think, I don't like it here anymore, I want to go somewhere different. You've got to be there until you can find a flat exchange or find another one that you can possibly afford to rent.
So to what extent were you sort of driving around on your own and choosing your own pitches, and to what extent were you, you know, sort of joining up with other people and doing similar kind of things?
In the winter, for practical reasons, most people would be in groups of, say, 6 to 12 vehicles, although obviously there were some much larger groups that travelled together, but most of the people that I knew extremely well, we'd always go off either on our own in twos and threes, yeah, because several people would have work at one place, but there was only work for maybe half a dozen people, so they'd have a regular arrangement every year, and they'd go and either pick fruit, pick grapes, or whatever.
Now, back in the 1980s, there was a whole sort of crackdown on the travelling lifestyle. I mean, many people see travellers as a sort of equivalent, in a way, to the gypsy lifestyle. To what extent would you agree with that?
Probably the culture is similar in some respects, but the two lifestyles are completely dissimilar.
So, okay.
And some of the values as well.
What about this whole thing of new age travellers? Because I can remember working in the early 90s at the BBC, and they say, oh, you've got to call these people new age travellers. Is that a term that you would be happy with?
People had to get used to it because it suddenly appeared. I seem to remember it might have even turned up on a BBC radio programme originally. The term was first coined.
Right, but would you have talked about yourself as a new age traveller? Obviously, you weren't a gypsy. You were just somebody who had decided to, look, I'm going to take this kind of lifestyle. So how would you have classed yourself, and what would you have called yourself?
We just used to call ourselves travellers. Other people gave it the moniker of either hippie traveller or new age traveller.
Okay.
Just called themselves a traveller because they did travel.
And tell us about the convoy, because that was the reason which was given. I mean, there was a lot of travellers seemed to come together in the summer on this pot of big convoy. How many vehicles were on it?
They probably got up to 250 vehicles in some of the bigger convoys, very occasionally. But the normal number that you'd see would be somewhere in between 50 and 100 vehicles, because the practicalities of moving more at one go and keeping them all going from end to end of the journey are absolutely immense.
Okay,
you're bound to get breakdowns.
How did you do that? I'm just wondering, you know, with 200 vehicles all going down the A303 at the same time, are you going to have a kind of travel warning on the radio for everybody else?
No, quite often they used to close the roads or divert traffic away.
Oh, okay. So where were your main spots that you used to go to in those days?
You tended to find that groups of people stayed in areas that they either knew, loved, or had some local connection with. For me, it was the West Country, although I went all over the place. And other people similarly, who'd come from, say, Derbyshire or Yorkshire, they'd spend all their time in that area. Yes, every now and again they would go off somewhere different. But most people generally stayed in a fairly fixed locality area within like two or three like counties.
So how did you actually keep your vehicle going on the road? Because I mean, for example, you may need to sort of pull into a lay-by and be your own sort of personal garage mechanic.
Well, personally, being a mechanic, it was never a problem. I could always earn money repairing something for somebody else that they couldn't fix. Even if they couldn't give me money, I'd at least know was at least going to eat that night.
But, Sean, I mean, you know, with something like a coach, you've got to if you have to, for example, change an engine, that's not the easiest thing in the world to do, is it?
I've done that in a wet, muddy field on my own.
Change an engine. How do you do that? You can't pick it up, can you?
On my own coach.
You can't pick it up an engine, can you? A coach engine. I mean, I would imagine that weighs pretty much a ton.
No, we got a farmer with one of these JCB loader things, and he like took the old one out and put the new one in for me.
Fantastic. Okay, so how did you start to experience the political end of all this when the government of the day in the 1980s, the Thatcher government, decided they were going to put an end to these convoys?
The media and the hype that surrounded the whole subject, it tended to get a bit extreme. It was very sort of scaremongering tactics.
Okay, so can you put the record straight? What was really going on?
The government was so worried by this sort of culture of freedom that people were now embracing and not being tied to a job, tied to an address, tied to a particular place, that for them, they didn't want too many people to be thinking about doing this. How would they have coped? They hardly managed with the very small percentage of travellers that there were in the country at the time. Probably, you say, you've only got 1% of, like, sort of the population were travellers, or even less of what we'd call new age travellers.
So were the police giving you a hard time? And is it particular police force areas that you used to have to avoid, or what?
Oh, sometimes you'd come up and there'd just be a whole complete roadblock and no, you're not going there. Or they'd try and get past your convoy, like they'd try and catch and take out the rear vehicles. So we had a little sort of exercise that we used to do for that, not necessarily recommended.
Which was, would you like to explain or go into a little bit of detail?
Yes, all people in the large vehicles, because generally you'd have about 6 or 7 coaches at the front of any convoy, they would what's known as double up, so you're filling both sides of the road. So any oncoming traffic is turning left onto the verge, or it's not coming.
Well, that sounds rather scary. I mean, especially if you've got 2 coaches on a single track road coming towards you, you're right, you're going to have to get straight out of the way of the road. Anyway, it does sound a little bit dangerous. And don't you think maybe some of those tactics worked against you, you know, because the police are going to make a big deal of this in the national press, aren't they?
But in some situations, it was the only thing that you could do. When you'd driven all day long, you'd spent every halfpenny of money that you had on fuel, and your destination that you were going for, and that you'd already been out surveyed, yes, this will be our site for a week or fortnight or whatever, you had to get there because you didn't have enough fuel to go much further. And sometimes the police did use the tactics of marshalling the entire convoy, however many vehicles, even if it's only 3 or 4, to a chosen spot that they'd picked, which obviously didn't always go down too well with this.
Okay, could you just explain how the sort of police clampdown on the convoy, the travellers, developed?
Well, of course, we had the bean field, didn't we, in 1985. And after that, I think it made a lot of people think, especially people who are travelling with young children and babies and things like that.
Well, this was a pretty shocking experience, wasn't it? But basically, the police diverted a whole convoy of vehicles into what's called the bean field. They were saying that they were going to basically like interview people, and instead they went around just smashing up vehicles. In fact, there was an HTV cameraman who was badly injured. And could you just tell us what you know about that particular incident?
Yes, I mean, it had been set up very, very carefully. People were on their way somewhere anyway. They weren't going to the beanfield. They were on their way to Stonehenge, I think it was, at the time when this occurred. And for the police, it was a tactic because they didn't want Stonehenge happening again, one of the largest free festivals that we used to have in this country.
Martin Summers, can you just also put in context here a little bit? I mean, we've just been talking about housing. Sean is one of those people that decides that he doesn't want to live in an ordinary house. He wants to have a more free and open lifestyle. We've also got many of our main roads in this country have got big verges, where in the old days, gypsies and travellers used to be able to pull in and stay there, that they can't anymore.
Well, it comes back to what I was saying earlier. Ultimately, you've got to give everybody in the society a living income, and then they can do what they want on the top of that. So you people might choose to have a travelling lifestyle. And then, of course, you can work on top of that because your benefit is fixed. It's not like an unemployment benefit. It's your money. And then you can go and do bits of work, like you were saying, you're doing harvesting and so on. And, of course, the miners' strike was in 1984, and they were using exactly the same tactics to stop the pickets moving around. And, in fact, it's illegal. You're not allowed to stop people from going there from A to B. And it was of an era. We remember that era quite well. I was around in that era. I remember it well.
Ultimately, though, isn't it actually quite good to have itinerant labourers, people around who people can possibly just do a few days' work here and there?
Exactly. And if we all had a basic citizen's income, we could all actually experiment with our lifestyles, and we could actually live in a nice way, which would be rather different kind of society than the one we live in. Now, that doesn't stop people being ambitious. They can go out and earn loads of money if they want to, but if they just want to have a quiet life, doing a little bit of work, you know, odd jobs, what's the matter with that? It's better. We've got 50% of our unemployed under 25s unemployed. We need to do something constructive with those people, and they're not all going to get jobs in industry. It just isn't going to happen.
Okay, Sean, I think we'll finish with you. Could you just give us an idea of what Mrs. Thatcher was doing when she was clamping down on that sort of lifestyle? Because you talked about it as having a kind of sense of freedom. What is it that we've lost then when we've lost our travelling community?
It's people's individual sort of basic rights, I think, to be able to choose whether they live in a house or whether they live at the side of the road or whether they live in a yurt or a teepee, like up in the woods somewhere. And these rights are slowly being eroded, like, yeah. And often it's the media hype surrounding it is revved up to a point where everybody's thinking these are terrible people, and we're just the same as anybody else. The fact we live in a vehicle doesn't mean you're not a human being.
Okay, and for you now, you're still able to make a bit of a living, aren't you?
I do, yes, and like a lot of the older travellers now, I'm moving onto a boat now, because a lot of us have found out the boat is one of the last things. You can't drive around in coaches anymore. It's not practicable.
OK, well, we'll wish you all the best of luck with that, and thanks very much for joining us tonight, Sean.
Thank you so much, Tony.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Now, Mitt Romney is tipped for the world's top job as Barack Obama throws his weight behind a US campaign for gay marriage this week. Romney's chances of election are likely possibly to increase considerably. But Mitt Romney would be America's first Mormon president, something that Mormon's founder Joseph Smith back in 1827 would likely have been very proud of. But what is the Church of Jesus Christ of the Latter-day Saints? What do the adherents believe? And what does their special extra book in their Bible, the Book of Mormon, say? Well, I'm joined now by Bishop Robert Webb from Whitchurch. Hi, Robert. Welcome to Drive Time.
Hello.
Now, first of all, what is this book, the Book of Mormon?
The Book of Mormon. We accept the Book of Mormon as another set of scriptures. It's a record of the ancient Americans and how, in particular, how Jesus Christ visited those people after his death and resurrection.
Okay. How did it actually appear? Because, I mean, obviously this has been in the 1800s. This book has appeared in the 1800s. How did it appear to Joseph Smith, who's your founder?
Okay. Joseph Smith was searching for which church to join. There was a lot of religious confusion at the time. And he prayed and asked Heavenly Father which church he should join. And in answer to that prayer, he had a vision where Heavenly Father and Jesus Christ appeared to him and informed him that he should join none of the churches at that time. And subsequently, he received gold plates, which he translated, which contained the record of the ancient Americans, as I mentioned before.
Okay, well, I've dug out a little thing from Wikipedia about this, because I think it's always interesting when you're looking at various different sects of different religions to find out how they started. This guy, Joseph Smith, is obviously a key character, and apparently in 1823, he was a young man desperately seeking buried treasure. Well, you know, this is another version, I suppose, okay. So maybe you can cut in if you disagree with what I'm saying here. Late in the evening, on the auspicious day of September the 22nd, 1823, he had a vision of an angel. It was the autumnal equinox, and he'd repaired to a hill near his home late that night and performed rituals necessary to invoke spiritual forces. He was gratified to obtain a vision of the angel Moroni, who directed him to where a certain treasure was buried. Now, is that something you're familiar with?
No, that account isn't something I'm familiar with. No, it isn't.
Okay.
The angel Moroni did appear to Joseph Smith, but it was in his room, at his home, not on a hilltop. He did go to a hilltop later on where he received the gold plates, but initially those visions were within his home.
Now, how did he actually turn these gold plates into the Book of Mormon then?
He translated them.
And they were originally written in Egyptian hieroglyphics, apparently, so that's quite an awkward job, isn't it?
Absolutely. He obviously had no knowledge of such things, so it was only through the power of God that he was able to do them. Because there's no way a boy of that standing would have any knowledge whatsoever of such things.
Okay, now tell us about your church. If I was to come to one of your services, what would I notice different to, say, an ordinary Protestant or a Catholic service?
What you would notice different, one, our Sunday meetings last for 3 hours, although they are divided up into various sections where the priesthood, the males meet separately, and then the sisters meet separately for lessons and discussions. Then we have Sunday school meeting, which lasts for 15 minutes. Then our main, what we call our sacrament meeting, which would be the equivalent of communion, which we have every Sunday, lasts for an hour. And what you would notice different is that members of the congregation take part within that service. I myself speak occasionally, certainly not every week, and we ask members of our congregation to talk on various subjects. We generally don't kneel in our meetings, and we don't stand for singing, which I guess are noticeable because most obviously Church of England Catholics do that. So it's that's the main things you'd notice that would be different.
Now, yeah. I imagine you have readings as well as from the Bible most people would know, also from your Book of Mormon.
Yes, but we don't do readings as such. People would prepare a talk on a given subject.
Like a sort of a sermon on a verse
on a verse, yeah. And elaborate on that.
Well,
yes.
Tell us something about the Book of Mormon. Tell us something that's in there that's not in the Bible.
It's not in the Bible.
Yeah. Or the normally accepted Bible, because I know you believe that that's kind of a another book, like any other book in the Bible, don't you?
Absolutely, yes. We accept it as a canon of Scripture, as we do the Bible, the Old and the New Testament.
So would you like to take a couple of stories or little tales from the Book of Mormon for us?
Okay, well, firstly, the main difference between ourselves and other Christian religions is our view of the Godhead. We don't accept the traditional Trinity version of the Godhead. We believe that Heavenly Father, Jesus Christ, and the Holy Ghost are three separate individuals. The Book of Mormon teaches that Heavenly Father and Jesus Christ have bodies that look like you and I. Okay,
and so that's in heaven, is it, or is it another spiritual plane?
In heaven, yes, yes.
Okay, and what else? What else is in the Book of Mormon?
Okay,
can you give us I'm trying to get. Imagine I'm at one of your services, hearing how your preacher or whoever it is that's speaking is going to be different to what someone who's just strolled into a Protestant church would have heard.
Right. Okay. Well, the Book of Mormon obviously contains stories of people. It commences with Lehi and his family and how they left Jerusalem, how they built ships to, a ship to travel the oceans and then landed in America somewhere, I'm not sure where. So we have accounts of their dealings and other prophets, how they prophesied of the coming of Jesus Christ and how they... how they taught of the atonement of Jesus Christ and how he would come at a future time. But the Book of Mormon obviously then covers such a long period of time that it comes right up to date when Jesus Christ was born.
Okay, what about, one of the controversial things to do with Mormonism is this whole thing of polygamy. A lot of people say, that this is not the right way to go, but the Mormons and certain parts of Islam say, yes, you can have as many wives as you want. What's your view?
My view, I've been brought up as a Mormon, and I'm now just coming up to 50, and in my lifetime, the Mormons have never practiced polygamy. There are various splinter groups that do. We've seen various documentaries about such things. Yes, in the early days of the church, plural marriage was practiced, but that ceased, I believe, in about 1890 was the official declaration where it was disbanded. And so since 1890, the church, the mainstream church, has not practiced that anymore.
Okay. All right. So, what about your? Do you ever have Americans over to preach? Because it's obviously an American-based thing, isn't it? Mormonism.
Occasionally, yes, we have leaders of our church. We have a prophet and 12 apostles, as in Bible times, and they travel the world. But however, there's only 12 of them. Well, 13 of them. And so occasionally they will come and you'll get to see them. The only other Americans you'll see will obviously be the young missionaries that that serve 2 years to go to different parts of the world to share their beliefs with others.
So you say you're talking about these 13 or the 12 or whatever. Is that the way that the church is organised? Do you have quite a sort of strict hierarchy?
Yes, it is very, very, very organised. I mean, I am a bishop, and I'm obviously responsible for my congregation. Then a group of congregations, about five or six, form what we call a stake, and then we have a stake president responsible for those. Then we have an area presidency, which would cover the whole of Europe, and then we have other authorities. Then obviously we have the 12 apostles. And the first presidency.
It's a bit presumptuous, isn't it, calling yourself an apostle if you're in charge of a church?
You don't take it upon yourself. You are called to do that. Obviously, one of the differences is we believe that this is the restored Church of Jesus Christ, okay? That through Jesus Christ there was a restoration of all things, which is why we have prophets and apostles. And since Joseph Smith, we've had a prophet continuously since then.
Okay, why the term the Latter-day Saints? What's that all about?
Just to differentiate between the early saints that lived in Bible times, these being the latter days.
So you're saying there's saints walking around there. Do you have your own kind of system for turning people into saints, like the Catholic Church
do? No, we're just calling a saint somebody that follows Jesus Christ, really, as the groups of saints that lived in Bible times, in various Christian communities, would be referred to as saints. So we're not in the same way as the Catholics would refer to a saint.
Now. Okay, and how many Mormons are there in Bristol and how many in Britain?
We have, in Bristol, we have three congregations, although there's one in Yate. So we have about 100, 110 coming to our congregation. So, in the Bristol area, maybe about 500-600.
And how about the whole UK?
Whole of UK, you're asking me something I don't know.
Okay, all right. So, just tell us where and when you meet, and if people are interested in finding out a bit more. I suppose, before we finish, I should ask you what your thoughts are on Mitt Romney, and whether he's going to be president or not.
Okay.
Maybe you've got an inkling, a message from God about that one.
Have I got an inkling? I don't personally know him. I don't really know any more than you know, other than if he is a good, faithful Mormon, then he will bring some good things to being president. He will be honest. His family will come first. He will stand up for morals. He would make a good president because of his values that he would have as a Latter-day Saint.
Well, Bishop Robert Webb, thank you very much for joining us this evening on Drive Time, and wish you all the very best. Assuming that you have services as most churches do on a Sunday, am I right?
We do, yes. Our services start at 10 o'clock on a Sunday morning, and our main sacrament service is at 10 to 11.
Okay, thanks very much for joining us. Well, that's all the serious talk out of the way, because Friday night is music night, 2 hours live with Pat Hart and the Fresh Blood Party Boys, followed by the UFO show. Thanks very much to our guest in the first hour, that's Labour Councillor for Southmead, Jenny Smith, to Will Stone from Avon and Bristol Law Centre at the bottom of Stokes Croft, and Whitchurch's Mormon Bishop Sean Webb, and also to Montpellier-based traveller and former squatter Sean. Of course, not forgetting Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Next week, Hengrove, Cribbs Causeway and Emerson's Green Rapid Transit Scheme. Bristol City Council consulting over May and June, so we find out if it's ever going to happen and also what it's all about. Plus, the far right beat up, hospitalised and permanently disabled an elderly Palestine supporter in Bristol City Centre in broad daylight. Avon and Somerset Police know who it is, so So why is the attacker still walking the streets? If you're on broadband internet, you can hear all our previous Friday drive times, including this programme's 5-point economic recovery plan, a report on mobile phone at masts and wireless safety, and our investigations into the 7/7 London bombings and 9/11 attacks on America. Every BCFM show is available online. Just go to bcfm.org.uk, or even easier, thisweek.org.uk. This show podcast is online about 10 minutes or so after broadcast. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Now, music for this week from 2004, Armand Van Helden at My My My. Do please join us on Friday drive time at 5 o'clock next week, and don't let the banksters get you down.